Hello and welcome once again to another episode of our March through Mark. We're going to start from Mark 10, 32 onwards. And they were on the road going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was leading them, and they were astonished, and those following along were afraid. And again, taking the 12 aside, he began to tell them the things that were going to happen to him. Look, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be handed over to the chief priests and scribes, and they will condemn him to death, and they will hand him over to the Gentiles. And they will mock him and spit him and flog and kill him, and after 3 days he will rise again. So, remember, we've got Mark is leading people on this story or journey towards Jerusalem. It's very important for Mark where Jesus is. And the road to Jerusalem, or the movement towards Jerusalem, is quite important. Jerusalem is, if you will imagine cinematically, it would be like all the forces of darkness are nipping at Jesus' heels, driving him forward or following him to Jerusalem. The idea is that there's all these enemies that are driving him there, but Jesus is not actually in thrall to them. So he's going to have power over them. He's always in command. But the forces do think that they are winning in a way. And so you have the popular forces, you have especially the scribes and the Pharisees, and especially you're going to have Rome. And it's all centering in some ways on Jerusalem. And now it's going to come up in a second to talk about baptism. So remember that baptism was an event. Jesus's baptism, he took John's baptism, which was in the wilderness, which was seen in lots of ways as a deliberate saying goodbye or death to all the centers of power and all the various forces which were finding that it was the cities and Jerusalem where that you had to gather and control in order to deal with Rome or deal with the Jews. Jesus had started his ministry out in the wilderness, away from all those. He's gathered together his group of followers, his kingdom, and he's exerted his authority over various forces of impurity and destruction and chaos. He is now moving to Jerusalem. So there's a real sense that the disciples who are following Jesus still haven't got it, because they are waiting for this moment to retake the center of power in the way that all freedom fighters are supposed to do. It makes a lot of sense. You gather together your Galilean rabble-rousers. Galilee was a well-known hotspot for freedom fighters and for a group called the Laestes, which we will meet in a second. They were the highwaymen, the brigands, the type that were seen to be rebels against Roman rule and the Roman roads, and they were the feature associated with Galilee. And Jesus has a lot of these people around him, and he's seen in some ways to be doing what you do when you want to take back Jerusalem. You gather around you the malcontents and the people who are suffering. You organize them, you feed them, you teach them, you lead them, and you move into Jerusalem to take it over. This is a normal feature, and people would expect that. And we will meet another chap in a second named Judas the Galilean. Well, next section, actually, we'll be talking about Judas the Galilean, who was a freedom fighter who did just this. So Jesus is, in some ways, on the surface, following a pattern that's expected, and the forces of evil are ranging around him, trying to stop him or pushing him towards this confrontation. The confrontation and the expectation of what a freedom fighter does when he redeems his people is being met, but Jesus is, of course, always subverting this in some interesting ways. So he's moving here towards Jerusalem, but he then has to, and they're astonished. And they're afraid. They're afraid because the disciples are aware what's going to happen. And they're anxious and looking forward to this and dreading it in equal measure, I think. And so then Jesus here in verse 32 takes the 12 aside, and we start to see the function for the 12, which of course is there's more than 12 disciples. There will have been thousands of people connected to the Jesus movement by this stage. We've just had the feeding of 5,000, 4,000, etc., etc. But there's 12 core people that Jesus is always teaching specifically. And he teaches them here. He lifts the veil off of the messianic secret. And he says, look, this is what's going to happen. I'm going to be handed over to these enemies. I'll be condemned. And I'll be handed over to the Gentiles. Now, Jesus uses the phrase Son of Man for himself. And again, the Son of Man is just to remind you, the Son of Man was a phrase associated with the Daniel 7 prophecy, amongst other things, but this was a main one, where the Son of Man is the one who comes shining in bright light, and he comes and sits and takes the throne or takes the spot of authority. And it's like there's a displacement. The sons of God or the divine creatures are displaced, and in their stead comes the Son of Man, who, another way of thinking of that, is the true human, or the human being, the human one. So Jesus uses this phrase for himself. And there is a sense here that Jesus is talking about himself, but to talk about Son of Man as a label is also in some ways to open it up for any human being. So there's an idea that the Son of Man is a label for Jesus, but that label itself has an openness that it could be any human. So, you know, if I called myself the human being, that's not necessarily me saying I am the only human being that's ever existed. It's me saying this is what a human being life looks like. And if you start to look like me, then you too will also be the human being. There is a sense of that this might be happening with this label Son of Man, the human one. And so Jesus is here opening up the idea that it's not just him who's going to be handed over to the chief scribes and Pharisees, and it's not just him who's going to be condemned and killed and mocked, because the way of discipleship is open to other people. An imitation of Jesus, imitation of the true human, is an option open to the Gospel of Mark, open to anybody. But here it's a specific teaching about I'm going to be killed and mocked, and then I will rise again. And James and John, the sons of Zebedee, approach him, not getting it. Teacher, we wish that you would do for us whatever we might request of you. So treating Jesus like a gumball machine or a wish fulfillment vehicle, a power endorsement. Everybody wants to have Jesus write his endorsement on the back of your paperback book, your self-help book that you're publishing for yourself. And here we go. Jesus, we want the ultimate endorsement from you. And he said to them, what do you wish that I might do for you? And they said, grant to us that in your glory, we may sit on your right and one on your left. So Son of Man comes in glory, is given the throne. And James and John go, yeah, we'll have some of that. We want to sit at your throne as well. One on your right and one on your left. We want to reign and rule with you. Again, there's irony here, because sharing in the Son of Man's glory and reigning and ruling with him is actually very much the vision of the New Testament and the vision for Jesus sharing his power with his disciples and sending them out. But the irony here is that James and John represent that the disciples still think that sharing in Jesus' glory means being a righteous, triumphalistic, dominating ruler type, and that sharing in his authority would mean getting the power to. Well, we know James and John in the Gospel of Luke were the ones that wanted to call down fire on the Samaritan village when they rejected Jesus. So James and John, the sons of Zebedee, or elsewhere they're called the sons of thunder, which could also mean the sons of anger, they have a reputation in the Gospels as being the ones who actually quite enjoy the idea of having the ability to wield divine power, and they always having to be corrected and slapped back and put back in their box. Here they are wanting glory, and Jesus says to them, you don't know what you ask. You know, can you drink the cup that I drink or be baptized with the baptism which I am baptized? So baptism here, the death to all the forms of organized, militaristic or righteous purity codes. So think of Pharisees, Herodians, Sadducees, Essenes, Zealots, all the different forms of resistance and attempt to stay pure. These are the forms of Jewish life that get rejected when you take on John's baptism. You're saying a no to all of that. I'm going to be reborn in the wilderness. So Jesus said, he reminds them of his baptism that he took. I said, no to all those forms of power. Can you do that? And they said to him, sure, we can. And Jesus said, you're right. See, again, there's irony coming on here. There's more irony in the Gospel of John, by the way. John is filled with ironic statements, people saying things, and they don't realize how true it is. But even in Mark, it does happen. And again, this is a form of the irony that the disciples are going to share in Jesus' glory. They are going to share in his authority, but they just don't know yet what that looks like. And he says, yes, you shall drink the cup I drink, and you will be baptized with my baptism. But to sit on my right and my left is not mine to give. It is theirs for whom it has been prepared. Verse 40, people will ask me what that means. I will admit, I don't know. It's not mine to give, but it is theirs for whom it has been prepared. I really don't know about that. I'll have to go do some more research on that one. And hearing this, the 10 began to be irate. You see, the other disciples aren't any better. So James and John are thinking this is all about authority and glory in their response to fear that's looming, the fear of Rome in retaliation and the Jewish authorities. And in their response, they want to have a move towards Jerusalem at the head of an army. And so James and John don't get it. But then again, neither do the other 10, because now they're jealous and annoyed. And they've just had, don't forget, they've, you know, just 5 minutes of reading time, 3 minutes ago, they were talking about little children and be like little children and don't jostle for power, don't compete with each other. They've just witnessed Jesus humiliate himself, take on humiliation at the hands of a less than human, foreign, demon-possessed woman. And then he loses the argument to her and he affirms her and elevates her. They've just been watching all of these types of activities and they still don't get it. They still are worried about how James and John are stealing some of the glory that they themselves want because they don't think there's enough honor to go around. And summoning them, Jesus says to them, verse 42, you know that those who are supposed to rule the Gentile peoples dominate them and their great men wield power over them. But it is not so among you. Whoever among you wishes to be great will be your servant. Whoever among you wishes to be first will be slave of all, servant of all. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and give his soul as the price of liberation for many. That's David Bentley Hart's translation. It's hard to find a clearer example here of the political aspect of the Gospel of Mark. This is an absolute height of Jesus' teaching in the Gospel of Mark, where it comes just before Jerusalem. We're about to see the temple clearing and all the events that are going to lead directly to Jesus' crucifixion is just around the corner. The whole thing is moving to this point. This is one of the key times when Jesus lifts the veil on the messianic secret and tells his disciples plainly what's going to go on. And it is all politics. It is the don't be like Gentile rulers who wield and dominate others, who lord their power over others. The whole teaching is catalyzed by this James and John coming and wanting glory and using the imagery of sitting at the right and the left hand and with authority and power. The whole thing is about being killed by the authorities. And this is about politics. I really don't know how else to say it to people. If you don't hear this, if it doesn't ring true, if somebody says the Gospel of Mark is all about politics and power and nationalism and racism and how groups and in-groups and out-groups define each other and what Jesus people are supposed to do with their power and their ability to define in-groups and out-groups, if you don't think that, if you don't feel that when we say that, that says a lot more about the Christianity that you inherited than it does about the Gospel of Mark itself. Mark is not hiding his agenda here. It's about power. And it's not about magic, charismatic, word of knowledge power. It's about when you organize yourselves, don't organize yourselves in such a way as that you dominate and lord your power over others. Be a servant to all. Organize yourselves in such a way so that everyone is seeking to serve the other. And it's not a hierarchical system, it's an egalitarian system. There's a sense of some kind of political anarchy about this, where the anarchists are organizing themselves in such a way as to not gather power, but to give it away. And of course, political anarchy leads to all sorts of problems when trying to organize yourself. Of course it does. But so does hierarchy and power dominant systems. Those also lead to problems. And so the problems that come from trying to organize yourselves in such a way so that everyone is empowered, those are the Christian problems. These are the problems that the New Testament now is trying to deal with as you read Paul's letters, for example. Paul and the early church leaders are wrestling with what happens when one tries to organize one's group according to the power dynamic of giving it away and treating others better than yourselves, and everyone submit one to another. And we're all many body parts, but one body. And no one body part is more glorious than the other. These are the kind of problems that the early church had to wrestle with, and they are coming directly out of Jesus's politics here, which is much more about giving power away and organizing yourselves loose, or holding your power with an open hand, not clutching tightly to what is rightfully yours, even if it is rightfully yours. And instead, it's organizing yourselves in such a way that you are always seeking to be the servant of all. For even the Son of Man, even the human one, the true human, did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life or his soul as the price of liberation for many. What's the gospel here? See, here there's even a gospel message right here in verse 45. You give his life as a ransom, or give his life as the price of liberation for many. I don't want to get into it too much because it's frankly a fruitless argument, but there's a lot of heat but no light around the area of atonement theory and what exactly does the cross do and what is the ransom for many mean, and is Jesus paying a blood sacrifice price? And there's lots of debate about this. It is worth mentioning, I'm not even going to get into it, but it is worth mentioning that the church, in all its wisdom, has never made atonement theory a matter for orthodoxy or heresy. So it's actually technically false whenever you find Christians who say, if you don't believe in penal substitution, that's a heresy, or if you don't believe in Christus Victor, or whatever atonement model you wish to hold on to, it is actually not a heresy to not have one of those. The atonement models are not a matter of orthodoxy, largely because the New Testament itself is not rock solid and clear. And so everybody in the New Testament knows that the cross is the point at which Jesus's glory is most revealed. The cross is the event in which liberation and freedom are realized. The cross, Jesus is the sacrificial lamb. There's a lot of this. The New Testament absolutely is crystal clear that it's at the cross that all this happens. It is less than crystal clear about what exactly was going on. And a lot of the New Testament is in fact trying to work that out. And so I think there's room to play. With Christians with goodwill and good intentions, there's definitely room here to talk about the atonement and not just instantly get shrill and get really angry. If somebody talks about penal substitution, they're not just talking about cosmic child abuse. And you shouldn't just dismiss them right away, because there is something of penal substitution in these texts. However, people who love penal substitution or substitutionary atonement theory, you also have to realize there is other things going on in these texts too. And penal substitution is not the only thing the liberation from sin can be understood in other ways besides that. And this is one of those texts where Jesus is giving his life as a ransom or a price of liberation for many. And if you read, for example, Mark here, 10:45, in light of the existence example, Colossians 2, you get the idea, and very, very firmly put in place, that it was at the cross that the powers and principalities were exposed to open shame. And it's at those places that they're nailed to the cross and they're exposed to open shame. And here we have the imagery from Paul that it was at the cross that the forces that are ranged against Jesus are exposed for what they are. And that it was at that moment of submission to them that they are revealed to be essentially grubby little gods who are doing a bad job running the world. And they're exposed for what they are. And then Paul will in other places, will go on to say that the role of the church is to bear witness to the powers. There's a lot there that I could say, but there's something, it's not impossible to read that in here as well into Mark 10. So when Jesus is serving others and not lording power over others, that is a gospel moment. That is how redemption from the forces that bind you is revealed and then enacted. Jesus serving others, the Son of Man, the true human, who's taking the authority from God and sitting on the throne, is showing that that means serving others, laying down your life. And in that moment, that is the redemption, or that is the gospel. That is the news that the rightful king has redeemed his people from their bondage. And the bondage is the addiction to lording power over others. The bondage here is James and John convinced that their relationship to Jesus must result in them having a place of dominance over others. The addiction that the other disciples seem gripped by, which is they can't imagine it being a good thing that somebody is above them, and they're annoyed and irate. This is the context for this teaching. The context for this teaching is not, I will redeem you from sin, even from sin, general sin. The context here is all power dynamics, conflict resolution, organization of groups in such a way that power is not lorded over others, like the Gentiles. So, even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve. And they come into Jericho, and as he was departing from Jericho, along with his disciples and a considerable crowd, a blind man, son of Timaeus, sits beside the road. And hearing that it is Jesus of Nazareth, he began to cry out and to say, Son of David. Now here's an interesting phrase. We're going to meet David soon as well. But Son of David, Jesus, have mercy on me. And many persons admonished him to be silent, but he cried out all the more, Son of David, have mercy on me. And coming to a standstill, Jesus said, Call to him. And they called to the blind man, saying to him, Take heart, arise, he calls to you. So throwing off his mantle and springing up, he came to Jesus. And answering him, Jesus said, What do you wish that I might do for you? And the blind man said, Rabbi, that I might see again. And Jesus said to him, Go, your faith has healed you. And immediately he saw again and followed upon the road. Just a few themes here that are we have met many times before. They are on the road, they're on the move. There's a considerable crowd around them. And along comes a blind man. Okay, well, first of all, Son of David. We're going to talk about that in a bit. But the Son of David, I mean, David is the king, the righteous king, the King Arthur type character, the fabled leader who's going to come and redeem his people at the greatest hour of need, that kind of idea. So for Jesus to be likened to David right now, there's an absolute political edge to this. David was a king. He was the great king. And so now Jesus is being recognized and identified with that name. And it's going to come up again in chapter 11. But this man gets it. The blind man, again, once again, the beggars and blind people and foreigners and demon-possessed women and all the all the less than human outsiders that one meets in Mark, they're all portrayed as the correct disciples. We've just had a story about the people who are in the inner crowd, the inner group, who knew Jesus better than anybody, could smell his breath. And they're the ones who Jesus has to just constantly tell, you don't understand, you don't get it, you are persistently in thrall to Satan and you need redemption. And then the outsiders, the ones who don't have anything going for them, they're the ones who immediately and instantly recognize Jesus for what he is. That itself is a teaching moment from the Gospel of Mark, trying to disciple and train his readership, I think, his community, to be alert and to be aware of what happens when groups develop insider, outsider, inner cliques. So anyway, they're telling the blind man to be silent, but he cries out all the more, Son of David, have mercy on me. He gets it. And coming to a standstill, Jesus says, call to him. Throwing off his mantle and springing up, he comes to Jesus. Look at all the movement here. Movement along the road, stopping of the movement, come to me. And he does. And answering him, Jesus said, what do you wish I could do for you? Verse 51, again, you know, quite a useful moment here that people who practice healing or prayer for healing quite rightly notice is that Jesus asks even blind people, he says, what do you want me to do for you? Jesus is affirming a humanity here. He's not assuming. He's giving that person the option to say what he really wants and what he needs. And Jesus is not just dominating his power over others. He's not just looking at them and saying, I know what you need. Here, have this. He's saying, say it out loud. What do you want? What do you need? Which is an empowering and affirming type activity. The other clue here, of course, that we are in the realm of power and politics is that earlier Jesus asked his disciples, James and John, what do you want me to do for you? And their response was, give us power. And now here comes the blind man. And Jesus says, what do you want me to do for you? And he says, have mercy on me. There's much more we can say about this. Later, remind me, we need to talk about Philippians 2 one day. But anyway, he says, what do you want? And the blind man gets to actually say what it is he wants, which is, I want to see again. And Jesus said, go, your faith has healed you. And immediately he saw again and followed him upon the road. Again, it's not really in the Gospel of Mark. It's not that the blind man was able to visualize in his mind what it was to see again. It's that he jumps up. There's this quick movement. There's this sense of immediately he jumps up. He throws off his cloak. He runs to Jesus. He shouts over the crowd in order to be heard by him. He takes great pains to be with Jesus. And Jesus says, your faith, your allegiance, your pistos, your allegiance, your willingness to be seen to be with me has brought healing to you. Healing as a form of recreation, of the creation of order out of chaos. Healing as specifically here as a restoration of relationship, because the blind man is being shunned, or he's not in the in crowd, that's for sure. He's at the edges, he's on the road. He's not allowed to be part of the crowd until he forces himself in. And Jesus looks at this man and says, you've been healed. Your willingness to be with me has healed you. And the man, in case you're under any illusion that healing is also always a political act, a social political act, which is all about reconnecting people back into their society, and friendships and networks, giving them a place and a purpose. In case you didn't think that was true. And immediately he saw again and followed Jesus on the road. We will do chapter 11 in the next episode.